Hi, my name is Elizabeth Nolan Brown. I am a senior editor at Reason Magazine, where I write frequently on this issue. And I am also the co-founder of a libertarian feminist group called Feminists for Liberty.
Hi, my name is Savannah Sly. I'm a sex worker and have been for a long time. I'm also the former board president of the Sex Workers Outreach Project USA, and I'm currently national coordinator for something called the Old Pro Project, which I work with Caitlin Bailey on.
I'm Maggie McNeil. I've done sex work on and off for 36 years now. I've been an activist and writer on the subject for, I guess, it's about 16, 17 years now.
My name is Caitlin Bailey. I am the founder and CEO of Old Pro Productions, where we tell better sex worker stories.
All right. We're going to go ahead and get right into it. Can our panelists better explain criminalization models and how they affect and impact people who trade sex?
Who wants to start?
Great. Yeah. So there are four basic legal models for policing prostitution. There's, the overwhelming majority of the country has full criminalization, where both the buying, selling, and facilitating of sex is criminalized. There's also legalization, otherwise known as regulation. The best example of that is in Nevada, which has legal regulated brothels. It also has the highest arrest rate per capita for prostitution in the country, and we can get into reasons. For that. There's something called end demand, otherwise known as the Nordic model or the entrapment model, where selling sexual services is not criminalized, but everything around it, from buying to facilitating, is. And then there's the issue that we advocate for, which is the full decriminalization of adult consensual sex work, where if you are having adult consensual sex with another adult, it's not a crime whether money is being exchanged or not.
And I have something to add to that. Something to add to that is we've seen a growing trend in the United States of a philosophical adoption of the entrapment model without actually following through on it. So under the entrapment model, people who provide sexual services are decriminalized while clients remain criminalized. We see this in many parts of Europe and also currently Canada. Here in the United States, a lot of people are inspired by that model, but they're not following through with it, meaning sex workers are still fully criminalized. Just more money for law enforcement stings and surveillance are going into arresting clients of sex workers.
And I'd like to add something to that, which is that even it all sounds very, very good when you say that under the Swedish model or entrapment model that sex workers are decriminalized. What that actually means is they cannot be charged with specifically the crime of prostitution. They can still be charged with just about anything else. So if two sex workers work together, they can be charged with pimping each other. If one of them keeps what we call an in-call, a place where she sees clients, they can be charged with brothel keeping. In some regimes, Canada specifically, they can be charged for putting an ad. There's all sorts of ways. And then there are some things that aren't specifically criminalization, such as being expelled from school, being deported from the country. Norway had a scheme called Operation Homeless, where they actually contacted the landlords of known sex workers and said, do you know that if you have this woman living in your place, you can be charged as a pimp, so that they would get evicted? And sometimes they get their kids taken away, that sort of thing. So it's not really decriminalization.
Can you tell us any specific situations where they were attempting to go after the clients of sex workers in, say, Florida, and conflated human trafficking with adult consensual sex work in a massage parlor environment?
I don't know if you guys know this story, but you may have heard there was a big bust about 2 years ago that involved Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots. And right away, law enforcement went out and said, we busted up a trafficking ring that spanned multiple massage parlors. We arrested 300 and something men, including Robert Kraft. And, these women were human trafficking victims. And as always happens, unfortunately, the media just sort of parroted that, and you know, it was everywhere because it involved a big name like Robert Kraft. It was on CNN, it was on all the cable networks, it was in all the newspapers, it was just everywhere that they had busted up this human trafficking ring at these Florida massage parlors. And people went beyond just this story too, you know, like it was this great point for everyone to be like, did you know that most Asian massage parlors are homes of trafficking? With, you know, there's not evidence of that, but again, like it gave all this fodder for sensationalistic media stories. And it turns out that these men that were all arrested were only charged with soliciting sexual services, and they never charged anyone with human trafficking. They never charged anyone with any crimes that involved force or fraud or coercion or minors. They, you know, if you look at the police reports, and Homeland Security was involved in this sting. Homeland Security for months tailed these women who worked at the massage parlors, who were mostly in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. They watched that. They went through their trash. They watched them buy condoms. This is all the kind of evidence that is in these police reports, which is like, we went through their trash and found 6 condom wrappers and stuff. They got a special warrant using a Patriot Act provision to put hidden surveillance cameras round the clock in the massage parlor rooms. And they did that for about a month at 2 of these massage parlors. So, you know, if there had been some sort of serious sex trafficking happening at these places, they should have caught it. And so they didn't, clearly there was not. There was just, you know, people giving massages and sometimes adding sexual services at the end of these massages. And when it came down to it, all of the women who worked there and who owned and managed these places were also arrested. The charges against the all of the clients ended up being dropped, which is a good thing because they didn't deserve these charges either, and they ruled that the surveillance camera pretenses that they used were actually unconstitutional, and that was pretty much the only evidence they had against the men, so they dropped all the charges against them. But the women who worked at these places, the ones that from the very beginning people swore that they were in this to save, were the only ones who ended up prosecuted and convicted and had all of their assets seized. One of the women had like over $30,000 seized. A lot of them had cars and a couple $1,000s seized. Basically, they had their life earnings seized, and now they have criminal records, all for things like promoting prostitution.
And this is not just happening in Florida. The reason that that's on our radar is because there was a high-profile client that was busted who was Robert Kraft. I'm from Seattle, and so is Maggie, and massage parlor raids are happening in droves in Seattle. There was a dozen of them that were shut down. There's always huge headlines about sex trafficking being ended, you know, and these businesses are being shut down, and they're ending these sex trafficking rings, but there aren't actually sex trafficking charges associated with these busts. What happens is people get charged for promoting prostitution, as like exactly what Elizabeth just shared, is happening all around the country, actually. We just know about this one because of Robert Kraft.
And I think it's really important to point out that, you know, just what Savannah said, the only thing that's unusual about the Robert Kraft case is that somebody as high profile as him was involved. But this is what quote unquote anti-trafficking raids look like in this country. And it's because of the false conflation between human trafficking and adult consensual sex work. Robert Kraft is a 70-year-old widower who paid a 45-year-old legally licensed masseur to massage a different part of his body. That's what happened. You know, we report it as illegal sex acts, and we pretend that it is part of this international conspiracy to enslave women. And that justifies literal SWAT teams descending on immigrant-owned businesses and, you know, attacking it. Just as Elizabeth said, mostly people that are presented in the media as victims are the only ones who are being charged. And just as Savannah and Maggie pointed out, this isn't isolated in Florida. I live in New York, and there was a tragic case of a woman named Yang Song who immigrated to this country with her husband legally from China. They started a business together. Her husband got sick, and a thing that happens with, you know, small business owners is when your partner in life and business gets seriously ill. You know, she lost her spouse and her business. She turned to, sex work, working in Queens. We know that she was raided, and we know that she was raped by a police officer because she reported it to her immigration attorney and also her mother. Less than a month later, as that same parlor was being raided for the second time, she was either pushed or threw herself out of the fourth-story window and died from her injuries in order to avoid being rescued, again, by a violent NYPD officer. That's what anti-trafficking operations look like in this country.
I want to add to that, too, that Yang Song's being raped by a cop in that context is not remotely unusual. Cops routinely, even in states that have said this is not legal, they do it anyway, cops have sex with sex workers under false pretenses. They refer to it as collecting evidence of prostitution. It's rape. There was a big thing in, what was it, Arizona, New Mexico, a while back, just a year or two ago. Liz reported on it, where Homeland Security ended up raping some very large number of people that they called sex trafficking victims. Same thing, same pretenses, so that they could then pretend to be heroes and pat themselves on the back and say, we saved all these women that we raped.
And we also just want to make it clear, we're not denying that exploitation and the sex trade exists. We know it does. A lot of us may have experienced that at one point in our lives. We believe that as sex workers who have a vast variety of experiences and who are within the community and connected to people, we feel that we have solutions to addressing exploitation in our industry that are not being taken seriously by people who have the power to determine what law enforcement does or doesn't do. For instance, the entrapment model, doubling down on arresting clients, we are not asking for that. and we feel that that actually increases the odds that we will be made vulnerable to exploitation, which is sort of complicated, but hopefully we'll get into it.
And yeah, that's not just our feelings. You know, there's a lot of empirical evidence. You know, every place that the Nordic model has been implemented, violence against sex workers goes up.
Well, and ask yourself too, just from a purely logical standpoint, think of yourself as a cop. Okay, you can't arrest a sex worker, but you can arrest your clients. What do? You set up surveillance on the sex workers you know so that you can then arrest people coming and going from her apartment under the presumption that, you know, that they're clients. And even to the point where there's a one of the main proponents of the Swedish model is a cop named Simon Hagström, who has actually published a book. And in the book, he has, among other lovely pictures, him sitting on the shoulders of another cop peering in a sex worker's window so that they can see her having sex and then arrest the client.
It's really crazy to think, too, that even on their own premises, like even if they're not just busting up consensual sex work, like say we think that these women that they're doing these things on are sex trafficking victims, that their way of saving them is to, for months, let them remain at the massage parlor or whatever site that they say that this is happening at, and meanwhile send in multiple undercover cops or confidential informants to rape them. And that is what they are doing with people that they say they are sex trafficking victims. Like, that's just insane, even on their own terms.
I will say that there is nobody more committed to ending violence and exploitation in the sex trade than sex workers themselves. Absolutely. And if you listen to sex workers and trafficking victims, and I know that Swap Behind Bars, you know, sees these with their caseload every day, you know, our top predators are not our clients. It's the police.
So that's going to lead us into another discussion of how do you think that these interventions to arrest clients impact the families of the clients, and how does it impact sex workers?
Go ahead.
You know, I'd love to tell a story, you know, because I have a friend of mine who is living, a friend of a former colleague of mine who's living in Michigan. And, you know, he was seeking the services of a sex worker. He had never seen an escort before. He'd also never had an extramarital affair. You know, his wife had been sick for a long time. He found himself in a sexless marriage. He had no intention of leaving, but, you know, he did want to seek the service of a sex worker. So he went online and had the bad luck of connecting with an online police officer who was role-playing as a sex worker, and used that conversation to set up a John sting. So he never actually had any sexual encounter with any real person, but was charged and convicted for trying to book an appointment with, you know, someone who presented themselves as a consensual adult sex worker. Not only did they charge him with a crime, but they published his mugshot in the town that he and his wife live in. And, you know, she
didn't mind that he was seeing a sex worker, but the public humiliation is what drove her to file for a divorce.
What do you think happens to the, maybe the small children, the daughters of men who are disconnected from their families because of the shame of having been arrested for seeking the services of a sex worker?
I can answer that one. On my blog, I get a lot of people writing me for advice. Sometimes it's about sex work, sometimes it's just relationships in general. And some of the letters can be really heartbreaking. And I remember one a while back from a guy who had been caught in a John sting, and you know, the whole thing, you know, his wife did not take it well and divorced him. And so he was trying to reestablish contact with his adult daughters, who basically considered him a monster and all this sort of thing. Because, you know, this is the thing. People, I think a lot of times when these carceral conversations happen, people want to pretend that that the people who are arrested for these victimless crimes are like gangsters from a movie or something. And in reality, they're people. They're people. They're your neighbors. They're people who work with you. And human beings don't live in isolation from each other. You know, humans have, we have spouses, we have families, we have kids. And you cannot harm a man or a woman, you know, a sex worker or a client or a friend, you know, of a sex worker associate. You cannot harm them. You cannot incarcerate them. You cannot put their pictures in the paper without also humiliating. I mean, I remember when I was a teenage girl. I mean, I think everybody here who was a teenage girl remembers, what would have happened if your dad had gotten arrested when you were in high school and had his picture in the paper? You wouldn't have been able to show your face. You would have died of embarrassment. And that's low-end effect. What about the loss of income if he's fired from his job because the company has a zero-tolerance policy for human trafficking, which happens all the time? Then what? Then what? Now his high income maybe is gone.
As somebody who did have a father who was incarcerated, for marijuana, my house when I was in eighth grade got raided by the FBI because my parents sold pot and that's how we made our living. They were artists and that's how I was able to afford to go to camp and things like that. And his picture wasn't published in the paper, but he did go to prison on a mandatory minimum sentence, which I have to say is one of the tactics we're seeing to try and fight sex trafficking is a bunch of passe war on drug tactics around profiling, civil asset forfeiture, all that. It's kind of a different conversation, but those are being popularized again and utilized by law enforcement in the name of ending sex trafficking, so I think that's worth thinking about. But the loss of income to our family and the destabilization, let alone the stigma, we just didn't talk about it. We didn't tell anybody in town. People would ask where my father was, and I'd say, he's just somewhere else. It's devastating. It's devastating. And my mom had to work four jobs. And one of the tactics, and that was marijuana, that's one thing, but I think there's a lot of correlations between marijuana and what's happening with the sex trade right now. One of the tactics to discourage, it's one of the end demand tactics, the entrapment model tactics, is shame and humiliation. There's the legal consequences and the financial consequences. Those are obvious. You will go to jail. You'll be fined to pieces. But then there are efforts to publish people's faces on billboards as labeling them as sex traffickers, which sounds, it's a monstrous title, and when really all they're doing is seeing usually consenting adult sex workers, or possibly even just trying, you know. So it really shatters families. We haven't talked about yet the impact on sex workers, but what is the impact on sex workers?
I mean, before I get to that question, I just sort of want to echo, you know, what Savannah is saying. You know, this false conflation between human trafficking and adult consensual sex work, and this false conflation between good clients and predators is detrimental to sex workers and trafficking victims alike. You know, when we say, that adult seeking the services of another adult consensual provider is the same as a serial rapist, we're doing our communities great harm. You know, not only is the criminalization of sex work preventing sex workers and trafficking victims from being able to come forward and report violent crimes committed against them, but it makes it harder, we shouldn't criminalize good clients. That's not helping anyone.
So we're going to get to the big question that everyone's really here to know. And that is, does the full decriminalization of sex work give traffickers a green light to exploit people?
I want to go with that one. It's kind of amazing to me how people get, they just lose their minds when the subject is sex, when sex is involved at all. We all know, every single person in this room, every single person in this country who's not living in a cave knows that the more you criminalize something, the more you create a black market. It happened with alcohol, it happens with drugs, it happens with anything you criminalize. But we are asked to believe by the prohibitionists that sex is magically different, so that when you criminalize it, it goes away, and when you legalize it, the black market increases because magic.
Decriminalizing sex work is not decriminalizing sex trafficking. Crimes such as rape, assault, robbery, kidnapping, murder remain crimes. But what you do when you decriminalize sex work is you enable people who are offering sexual services, regardless of them circumstances, to reach out for help. Right now, if a sex worker such as myself, if I am assaulted, there's no way in hell I'm calling the cops, because last thing I need is the double whammy trauma of handcuffs. We like to say around here that help does not begin with handcuffs. So when you decriminalize, you allow law enforcement to better identify situations of exploitation versus consensual sex work. One of the greatest disservices that we have done recently in attempting to combat sex trafficking is taking down websites like Backpage. People tend to think of Backpage as, oh, it's a hub for sex trafficking. No, it's an advertising platform where sexual services were sold. And what it allowed people to do, this is like, there's concrete evidence. There are case files of people who... investigators would use Backpage as a tool. You can literally look through the pictures, and if there's a missing person, a young person, you can go through and look at the files and be like, oh, that might be them. Let's call the number and go meet them. When you get rid of those, A, it's a great disservice to sex workers because we can no longer safely advertise online. It literally drives more street prostitution because it doesn't mean people are going to stop working. And then it's so much harder to find those victims. It just makes no sense.
Yeah, Backpage had a long and celebrated history of working with law enforcement to find victims of exploitation and missing children. That's something that you often don't hear about, but there is consensus in law enforcement that the shuttering of Backpage, the removal of Craigslist erotic services, the places where sex workers and clients could schedule and screen appointments with one another, really had a detrimental impact, not only on, you know, forcing sex workers into more vulnerable and, you know, potentially exploitative situations, but also really hindering law enforcement's ability to find genuine victims. You know, we spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on these surveillance tactics and SWAT teams and Homeland Security digging into, places where consensual adults are trying to connect to exchange money for erotic services. But at the same time, we are not processing rape kits. We are not taking the very real complaints when people come and report actual crimes committed against them. If you want to help sex trafficking victims, believe them when they come to the police and they report assaults committed against them. But don't conflate their experience or try to impose a narrative that they're not coming to you with. If we can stop arresting consensual adult sex workers, we free sex workers to report suspicious behavior, violations, including violence. You know, I'm from New York. A lot of these folks are from Seattle. In New York, we had the Long Island serial killer. You guys had the Green River serial killer. In both cases, there were dozens of sex workers ready and willing to report real evidence to law enforcement of an active serial killer, but they couldn't secure immunity. And so that person went on to continue. I don't remember how many people the Green River killer reportedly killed.
It was a lot.
Over 100. Yeah, over 100 dozens. In both cases.
I want to provide a contrast to this. In New Zealand has decriminalization. In fact, the New Zealand model, as we call it, is pretty much the closest to what we would consider a perfect. It's not perfect, but it's close, you know. They did that in 2003. Mm-hmm. Now, Some sex workers, I'll give you a little bit of setup here. Some sex workers don't like handling money directly. They prefer to be given to them in an envelope. So it's just a little bit more discreet. Some unscrupulous clients once in a while will use this as a way to defraud them, like putting small bills between big bills, that sort of thing. Well, a sex worker in New Zealand about, I want to say, six or seven years ago, I covered it in my blog. She discreetly checked the envelope while the guy was in the bathroom or something and found shredded paper. So he was going to try to cheat her out of actual money. She, before he got out of the bathroom, got on her cell phone, called the cops. They came, took the guy to an ATM, and forced him to get the money out.
That's the future sex workers want.
Yes.
I'm sorry, one more thing, but when we decriminalize, clients are also on the front lines and able, like, we need to equip clients to identify situations of abuse, and most clients want to. I can't tell you how many clients have asked me, because they hear the sex trafficking narrative, and they don't want to participate in that, and they ask, how can I tell if someone's trafficked or not? And I'm like, well, let's talk about that. And then I've also had clients tell me about, oh, once they went to a, you know, they went to an appointment, and it was a bad situation, they could tell that it was not good, and that this person was being hurt, and I'm like, well, what did you do? And they're like, what could I do without endangering myself and ruining my life?
So if you could all give us an idea, what can we do to better serve people who train sex and also experience violence and exploitation?
I think the thing that so many of us have spent, you know, so much time advocating for is we want to be heard. You know, it's important for legislators and policymakers and members of our community to listen to sex workers. You know, we ought to be at the table when these big policy decisions are being made, and we can, you know, help legislators avoid some of these obvious pitfalls. We need to be included in the conversation on a legislative level and on a more personal level. When we report violence, when we talk about the difficult and complex reality of our work, we need to be listened to.
A lot of things. We can do a lot of things to help sex workers and people who are exploited. As somebody who has experienced exploitation, and a number of my colleagues have, I know that people need options. When people have access to the basic things that we all need to have a stable life, I'm talking about a roof over your head, clothing on your back, access to just basic funds to get food and things like that and pay your utility bills, that's going to mean that somebody is far less vulnerable to have to make very hard choices that might put them in endangerment. They might be less lured into situations where they lose control or lose power. Things that we can do to empower people, like sex. So since the internet came along, a lot of sex workers became independent. And by independent, I mean working for ourselves. It's fantastic. Sex workers used to have to rely more on people who would procure clients for them because it was like a Rolodex. People had different Rolodexes. But with the internet, so I'm talking about giving sex workers access to hosting and to online advertising, to not shutting down our websites and things like Backpage, those online marketplaces, because I can take my own photos, I can create a Wix page, I can advertise, I can screen my own clients. I'm in full control. That's what we want. We also want to allow sex workers to be able to work for each other, because not everybody wants to do all that, you know? But also in banking is very important. So something that's been very difficult. Sex workers are actually first movers on things like Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies by necessity, because in the name of ending sex trafficking, very well-intentioned people seek to cut off traffickers' access to money laundering and by flagging cash deposits at banks. I can't tell you how alarmed I am by the increasing frequency of seeing my peers, my colleagues, have their bank accounts shut down without notice or explanation because of regular cash deposits of like $1,000. We make cash generally. Please don't cut off our banking. We need access to banking. We need access to advertising and the internet.
Yeah, it's really hard to help someone that you're hunting. Taking money opportunities away, trying to imprison people or identify them. You know, I think the first thing that we could do to help sex workers is call off the arrests.
You know, I can speak from personal experience. I started full-time sex work in 2000. Within months, because this is just the kind of person I am, I realized that there were too many bad escort agency owners in New Orleans, which is where I was from. So I started my own agency, which I had no real intention of doing because I hated all the bad escort service owners and I wanted to be a good escort service owner. And so I did, and within a few months, actually, most of the new girls, you know, that hadn't done the work before would all come to me because I had that reputation. But as years went on, I watched as the internet expanded. I watched, it was harder and harder for me to get girls to work for me because they were now able to work independently. They didn't need the intermediary. They didn't need me to do advertising for them in the phone book, which costs, you know, thousands and thousands a year. They didn't need me to process credit cards. They didn't need any of that. And even though I was a good service owner, I was kind of glad to watch that drying up because I knew that that also meant all the bad service owners that I had disliked were now getting out of business. And so I closed my doors in 2006 because I said, nope, mission accomplished, done now. They can do their own thing. So, I mean, I watched it happen. And now we've got people trying to, you know, as Savannah says, sometimes with the best of intentions, trying to close down bank accounts, close down advertising venues, basically driving people back to services that might be exploitative.
Something we haven't really talked about that I think is really important is youth that are involved in the sex trade, which is an incredibly concerning topic, obviously. When we federally, the definition of sex trafficking is anybody under the age of 18 or somebody who's there by force, fraud, or coercion. I know all of us know people who have been youth who had, they were kicked out of their house, their parents weren't present, they had to grow up very quickly, they had to learn how to take care of themselves, and there are young people who have to make incredibly hard decisions, and when I think of sex work, I mean, we can think of like cash for time or cash for sex or whatever, but a lot of people are trading sex for a couch to stay on, for a meal at a restaurant, and young people are in those positions, so I would really advocate for expanded services for youth and paying more attention to our youth. And like all youth should have a roof over their head and they should have access to basic needs because that would really, really decrease the odds that they will get into an exploitative situation. And also we need to decriminalize youth. I again am from Seattle, Washington, where youth are technically sex trafficking victims, but they are also, they can be charged and prosecuted with prostitution. That's crazy. That needs to, we need to start with decriminalizing youth immediately.
And two, because of the sex trafficking narrative, we see things like over and over. There was a woman in New Orleans a few years ago who was convicted of sex trafficking. She was a sex worker herself. She was a street worker, but she was a pretty stable. You know, she had her own apartment, everything. An underage sex worker that she saw was in trouble, and she said, "Hey, you can sleep on my couch. You can take a shower in my apartment." For taking a shower in her apartment and letting her sleep on her couch, she was convicted of sex trafficking because she assisted the younger girl to do this. So presumably, I don't know what the law expects, that she would, I don't know, grab her and call the cops on her or something, I suppose. But in trying to help another human being, that was called a felony.
This even happens to underage people also. Like, there are certain cities that are really bad for this. There's this one case that in Topeka, Kansas, where this young woman, she was 14 when she got involved with this man who was abusive. She moved in with him. She had a child with him. He was, you know, beating her and also taking all of her money from sex. And she was underage. And he had her recruit friends. She recruited one of her friends who was also a teenager. And that girl came and lived with them. So when police got involved, they charged him with sex trafficking, and then they also charged her with sex trafficking. She was 16 at the time. They charged her as a sex trafficker because at the direction of her trafficker, she had recruited this other teen to come and live with them, and they prosecuted her. She actually got a longer sentence than him because he, for some reason, got aggravated. I think he took a plea deal and got attempted sex trafficking, and she actually got charged with sex trafficking. And after this, the local public radio station did an investigation, and I think they found something like 25 young girls, like underage girls, who'd been charged with human trafficking in the past 5 years or something in and around the Topeka, Kansas area. Like, it's just insane.
I think the criminalization of youth is egregious. I think that you guys are absolutely right. And I also want to draw your attention to sort of the expansion of the definition of youth. You know, like what's happening in Texas in strip clubs is a problem. I'm not sure if you're aware, but there was recently a law passed, signed into law in Texas, raising the age that people can work as erotic dancers from 18 to 21, which means overnight, every 18, 19, and 20-year-old stripper in Texas lost their job. What do you think they did for money? I mean, this wasn't a help to them. They weren't being rescued out of their legal occupation. They were being pushed into criminalized full-service sex work.
I'd like to thank our panelists, and I'd like to open the floor for any questions that our audience might have.
Oh, here.
Here's a mic.
It's a pretty quiet room, though.
Maggie, big fan. One of my favorite things that you've ever written or said is that sex workers are often the canaries in the coal mine. Can you talk a little bit, or all of you talk a little bit, about some of the civil liberties implications from the government overreach that results from these banking measures and from SESTA, FOSTA, things like that?
Well, in general, throughout history, it's the wedge effect, right? If you're a tyrant and you want to tyrannize people more, who do you start with? You always start with people that nobody is going to defend. You don't start with you know, little old ladies who bake cakes. You start with hookers. You start with some despised minority. You start with some group that you can say, they caused this to happen. Those are the ones you start with. But because there's this thing called legal precedent, which a lot of people don't seem to recognize the power of, once you've made it criminal for members of that despised group to do X, it doesn't take very long for you to expand it to others. Caitlin was talking yesterday, about in one of the panels she was on, about this thing that happened in New York recently, which, absolutely, now that they're saying, oh, sex trafficking victims, they publish these checklists of things that are supposed to be signs of trafficking, and one of them is a woman traveling alone. And so you actually had this high-profile restaurant in New York say, we are no longer going to serve female customers alone because they might be hookers. There was a bar in Sweden that the owner said no Asian women allowed because stereotype Asian women are prostitutes, right? A judge upheld it. He said it's perfectly okay to discriminate against Asian women as long as you say it's because they might be hookers.
Yeah, so the economist Bob Murphy says that the normal arguments against prohibition gives the cops too much credit. And I was surprised, I just recently heard this a few months ago, and he said it's not that it's illegal and you can't call the cops, it's that it's on the street and there's no security. There's no building, you can't put up a building and sell drugs out of it, drugs are illegal. So I imagine you don't want to depend on the cops either. You don't want to go from them being the enemy to the savior. So what are your thoughts on brothels and security, buildings? And the second part of my question was, how real or what portion of supposed sex trafficking is actual sex trafficking, just percentage-wise, so I have an idea of not overplaying or underplaying the problem?
If I want to start with the number question, and then I'll pass it to one of the others for the rest of it, because we all know all of this backward and forward, right? from the best figures we can see, and this is very, very rough, because it's really hard to get good data on a criminalized population. But worldwide, we keep seeing that the rate of actual exploitation, in other words, things that are defined by the victim as exploitation, not things that are defined by the police or politicians as exploitation, is among domestic sex workers. So in other words, that they're native to the country that they're working in. It hovers around 2% of all sex workers. Among migrants,
who are adults, it hovers around 5%-ish. And among minors, it hovers around 10%. So 90% plus of people who are doing sex work are not coerced in any way other than circumstantially. I mean, obviously, if you want to say, well, you're coerced because you have to pay the bills, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, an actual coercer. It's a pretty low number, and a lot of the things that are genuine, bona fide coercion, the vast majority of it is people that they know closely. It isn't women being abducted from street corners or malls. It's domestic violence. It looks like domestic violence because it is domestic violence. And I'm going to leave, go off on after this, but one of my favorite statistics is that 2% that I just gave you, it happens to also be roughly the percentage of women who report having an abusive or controlling boyfriend is also roughly 2%. So if 2% of sex workers are controlled or abused, and 2% of all women are controlled or abused, why do we consider them different things?
I do want to say that we will get pushback on what my colleague Maggie just shared as far as statistics. A lot of people would disagree with that, and they'd be like, well, it's different in other parts of the world. And it's like, well, yes, every country is different. There's cultural differences globally. There's a global sex worker rights movement that we share the same values with. It's all over, like, India, Thailand, Japan, Cambodia, Turkey, South Africa, all that, like Kenya, Nigeria. There's sex worker rights groups, all, and they all want decriminalization. They're all saying help does not begin with handcuffs, and people need basic resources so they're not vulnerable to exploitation. We don't want law enforcement raid and rescue interventions.
We always caution people, I believe, to be very careful. I think there's even been a couple of papers written about it, about to be very careful when you're trying to put a number on the number of this or the number of that when you're talking about marginalized populations, because it's virtually impossible for us to gather accurate data about that, because they're scared, and they're scared because they're not safe when they come forward.
I don't want to leave your question about brothels unanswered. I don't have a problem with brothels. I do have a problem with state-enforced monopolies, which is what we have in Nevada, where the only way to work legally is to register as a licensed prostitute, which is something that is subpoenable about you for the rest of your life. You have to be hired by a brothel, and you have to follow a truly Byzantine system of like state and county and city and brothel laws. And of course, the managers of those brothels don't like to distinguish between their like house preferences and state law, you know, which makes it difficult for workers to navigate. Speaking for myself, I worked as an indoor sex worker. I was lucky enough to work in the early 2000s and, in 2010 before the passage of SESTA-FOSTA, where I was able to schedule and screen my clients online and set up places to meet, at hotel rooms. I was able to use a social network to provide security. But there are there's absolutely a demand for folks that can, create spaces where people, not everyone that wants to work in the sex trade wants to build a brand and be an entrepreneur where they are like advertising and answering emails and doing all of the screening. Like some people just want to show up, work a shift, and then go home. You know, we don't have any problems with that. But when you create a licensing scheme and you make that the only legal option, you end up creating a two-tiered system that leaves the overwhelming majority of people in the sex trade out of work. I will also say, I know a lot of people who have done street-based sex work, and there are ways of screening clients, standing and having a conversation before getting into the vehicle, using social networks, clients become known among a group of sex workers. You'd be amazed at the ingenuity of folks that have been engaged in the oldest profession. You know, technology changes, but the work really doesn't. And so the problem with criminalizing clients is that it severely hinders screening, both from indoor sex workers, right, online, because people don't want to provide you their legal name, they don't want to provide any information about themselves because they don't want to be giving information to the police, but it also really hinders street-based sex workers from being able to screen effectively because you can't tell the difference between somebody who's nervous because they're afraid of being arrested and somebody who's a predator posing as a client. And so it has a detrimental impact on really all levels of sex work.
So I was going to ask the same question as far as the percentage on the human trafficking versus actual consensual sex work. So my backup question is there a difference between decriminalization of sex work and legalization of sex work? That's the first one. And then second question is, and full disclosure, so I think it should be totally legalized. But there was a previous debate at Freedom Fest like 2-3 years ago. Dennis Hoff was there, and it was interesting debate from libertarians on this subject. Should it be legalized from a state level, from a federal level, from a city level? And the counter argument was, you know, should we force the Amish in Pennsylvania to have legalized prostitution over their sex work? So just curious on your guys' thoughts on that.
We're not about regulation, are we, libertarians?
No.
Yeah.
Dennis and I had this argument several times. Dennis was a businessman. Mm-hmm. He was not political. He liked to pretend to be political. So Dennis would espouse political positions that he thought sounded good, but in reality, Dennis was all about the salesmanship. So I don't know what he really believed, but he obviously espoused the rhetoric that basically whores can't be trusted and they need to be shepherded and managed. And that's what he spread, up until the day he died. But decrim versus legalization, the real simple one-line version is decriminalization is treating sex work like work. It is regulating it only by the same kinds of rules that regulate other businesses, not special rules that only apply to the sex trade. Like, for example, if a restaurant has a violation of the health code, what happens? A guy comes in, says, hey, health code violation, writes him up, you got a week to fix it or you'll be fined. What doesn't happen? He doesn't bring a squad of cops in there, arrest the chef, arrest the owner, arrest the diners, arrest the waiters, take them out of prison and put their pages in front paper.
I want to add to that Dennis Hoff certainly benefited from a system, that forced sex workers to work for him, right? There are a lot of brothel owners in Nevada that are still with us today that are very invested in a system that gives them, a state-controlled monopoly. And that's the real difference between legalization and regulation is efforts to regulate prostitution inevitably lead to sort of licensing schemes or red light districts. And I think it's important to remember that, as Maggie said, sex work is work, but it is also sex. And so when you create laws that allow police officers or allow law enforcement to regulate the, consensual sexual choices of adults, you are opening up your own sexual choices to the scrutiny of the state. And the bad news that I have for the Amish is that they are already living in neighborhoods where all kinds of sex is already happening all around them.
Yes, I don't have a question. I just would like to lavish praise on all four of you, indeed all five of you. I have learned so much, and I have agreed with 100% of everything each of you said.
Thank you.
And my hope is that you can get the word out, globally, not just nationally, but to, governmental authorities and everything, because it's so logical and it's just such common sense. It really is. So congratulations, and keep up the word, because every point you made, I think, was irrefutable.
Thank you.
Okay. You can support our work by going to our website at www.swapbehindbars.org and to the
oldproinc.com.
Oldproinc.com. Listen to that podcast. You have to listen to that podcast.
And Feminists for Liberty. You can support all of our work material. We'd be like, don't thank us, pay us. Thank you.
So before we run out of time, I got a quick question, real quick. I'm a simple guy. From an exploitation standpoint, it seems like the society hates the idea of trafficking and exploitation, whether it be men or women in this world, right?
Absolutely.
And I'll be honest, you guys have opened my eyes at this event. I never even thought about it before. Never even thought about it. Would it not be easier to identify the exploitation if we weren't blinded by the persecution of consensual sex between adults?
Yep.
It just seems like it.
Yep.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. I think we all just
thank you all so much. There is some literature on the table if you're interested in the impacts of some of these criminalization models. There's information.
I don't want to take it home.
And there's also information on some of the global perspectives because this is a global movement. Thank you.